in Studio 2, Honda Element.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I have a 1985 Westfalia camper van.
I read
I
that. A
call
friend
that.
of mine had one of those. He popped top.
Popped up. Yeah. Let's
Yeah.
see what. Let's see how quiet this is. Okay. Let's see. I got parrots out here too, though. It's funny.
Your about or description on your website is very good. I've read a lot of different bios for people. Because there's always those ones that you read that's like, oh, I create pictures that do this. And yeah, I read that on five other people's bios. But yours is nice. It gives a good picture of who you are as a person, not just rambling about how you want to make the prettiest pictures.
I'll give you just a quick little capsule for the people to understand where I come from. I'm originally from New York, but I spent the majority of my life just outside Washington, D.C., and I feel like that was my education, going to the Smithsonian's all the time. Unconsciously, I was getting the message that artists have an important place in society, and the size of these buildings and the amazing art and photography and sculpture that was inside there. That had a strong influence on me. And I started doing still photographs. My sister was a dancer. My brother was a costume designer. You could physically see what they were doing. But for me, I was the youngest. I felt like I needed a tool. And so that camera helped me become an artist. It didn't happen to me naturally. I couldn't draw like my brother. I couldn't dance like my sister. Kind of had to hide behind this little Nikon black box in order for me to be an artist. And through trials and tribulations, and I had a high school teacher, Miss Kraft, that saw something and pivotal person in my life to get me into photography, and just kept shooting. I didn't go to USC. I didn't go to AFI. I was at VCU in Richmond on the Art Foundation program doing art, and I wasn't an artist, but that's what you had to do to get into filmmaking. And then I transferred and went to an art institute for still photography. Did that for 2 years. Was working as a photographer in Florida, in Orlando, when they opened the studios there. And I just got into this one little class for people to like start to become crew for all the work that was going there. Supposedly it was Hollywood East. And I took that class, somehow broke into the industry. I was doing it as a still photographer. But then within that first class, hopped on the Panavision on the dolly. I don't know if it was ego or just magic, but I was like, I got to be here. Geared head, 1,000-foot mag, 10-to-1 lens. And I just started making that transition. And I would say on the first job I worked on, it took a while to get my first job, but I probably learned more in the first three jobs that I worked on set than you could ever have learned in any school. It's much more important. It's like, don't think that you have to go to some high-end film school. You can go to film school online now, nofilmschool.com and all these other ones. They have all these amazing things, but really what you need to do is just get out and shoot. Just get out there and make mistakes and just keep making things and edit your own footage and look at it, because when you're cutting your own footage and looking at it, you will not do those things again. You'll do the things that you like, but not the things that you don't. And that's really how you can learn and accelerate your process very quickly.
Let's just jump right into it. I watched your film Heal a couple days ago, and I was quite impressed by the skin tones, which is one thing that really stood out to me. And I think that goes hand in hand with a few different factors. First question I want to ask you then, just to get right direct on technical, is your lighting on the film, because it had a very consistent approach. And I'd like to know if that was a consistency you developed with the director ahead of time and said, this is a look that I like, or is this a look that you gravitate towards and you put into all of your projects? How did you decide on the placement of your light?
For the lighting on Heel, the conversations I had with director Kelly and the ideas we were going for is I showed her some of the things I had done. She was telling me some of the different looks that she liked. And for me, I knew the film was going to be about healing. Anytime you start a project, you really have no idea how it's going to turn out or how big or small it can be. You come up with your ideas. And then the important thing is that you stick with them. If you like your idea, stick with it. Don't change it up. If you're going to change it up, make sure it's at the beginning. So what I came up with at the beginning was really about using light and shadow as the metaphor for sickness or healing, breaking through. It didn't end up getting used that much in the film, but I did a ton of shots of people going from bright sun into shadow places or walking out of them. So there's a visual metaphor of them stepping out into the light. I like to shoot in a metaphorical, philosophical way. Now, so for the interviews, what I do there and I try to do in general is I like more of the Taoist philosophy that flow with nature. I don't like to ever go against nature. So I walk into a room and whatever is happening naturally, I'm going to just accentuate that. I walk into the room, I assess the situation, I see what's happening naturally, and then bring that natural light into what the camera's range can handle. So either through the use of NDs or through my lighting. So normally I would ask for locations that were as long as possible and had natural light. We have the iPhones now, so it's easy for people. One of the easiest things you can do is just ask them to stand in the middle of the room, hold the camera horizontal, and slowly turn in a 360-degree circle. And then if it's possible, you ask them which way is north or east or west or south. Since we have artificial intelligence, nobody seems to know which way is north anymore or east or west. Sometimes they know where the sun goes down or comes up. But this is a very good way, like on documentaries, you think it's very run and gun and this and that, but it's not. It's the same as a feature film. You know, I always make sure that the producer and director, that they add wardrobe notes, because wardrobe is a major factor. You want to have a consistency. Which color palette are you working with? You know, you don't want people showing up in stripes and fine patterns. We always ask people to bring a change of clothes, two or three options for us. No stripes, no small patterns, no logos. Because when you don't give people direction, it's amazing what they show up in. Personally, I usually ask for like a solid tone, slightly darker than their skin tone, because I want their face to come out. I don't want a bright white shirt that I'm going to have to fight with the whole time.
Oh, I felt that for sure in your film. Just everybody's faces glowed. That's just the skin tone and the warmth. They just popped, and you had these big catch lights in their eyes. Very, very engaging looking at these people. Besides the fact that they were just engaging people to talk to in general, just the look that you gave it, very compelling.
It's very funny because oftentimes you look at the set and there's so much stuff everywhere. Just the amount of stands. It's not that many lights, but the amount of stands at times. And you're like, it's phenomenal what it takes to make this look natural. I feel like everybody in that film pretty much looks like they just sat down next to the perfect window and it just happened to be perfect right there, and they didn't do nothing. No, there's a lot of stands around. And basically what I do is I walk in, I see what's happening naturally, and then I accentuate that. And the way I normally accentuate it is, let's just say there's a bank of windows on the right. I know that that's going to be my key light. That's where it's going to be coming from. So right off the bat, I know the person I'm looking at, they're going to be looking camera right, because I want them looking towards the light source so I get the shadow side towards the camera, right? That's the first thing. So right off the bat, you walk into a room, you see where the light is coming from. Then I look where the background is. Can I get a highlight somewhere back there? Is there a window far away? Do I have to create the highlight? So I'm looking either one way or the other. Which one's going to give me the best background that I can create something? Or am I going to have to land a lamp there or something like that? Or can I get a natural highlight? And then once I decide that, let's just say the background is good in this direction. So the window is on the right. I set the talent, you know, not close to the back wall, in the middle of the room as much as possible. And I have them looking towards the light source. And then I'll set the director down and I'll back the camera up as far as I can so I can use the longer end of the lens so I get a nice bokeh in the background and leave the director just off of frame like that so that they're close enough that they can feel connected with the talent. And then most of the time I'll arm over a small LED with a little light box on it or some diffusion so that it basically cleans them up. And I like it when there's a dimmer on there, because sometimes the window light is so nice it barely needs anything. You know, I usually tell people, like when I'm doing stills or something like that, or even when you're there, when there's really nice window light, sometimes all you need is a fill card. And I'll often joke about the day rig. I'll take the fill card away and I'll go 500, and then I'll bring the fill card in and I'll say 5,000. And that's basically the difference between amateur and professional right there. Sometimes all you're doing is just accentuating what's happening naturally there, and it brings it into the range that the camera is in, you know, the shoulder. It's like, oh, you know, I brought it closer. And the camera's like, thank you. I'm not struggling so much anymore. I don't have to like try to fix this or something. So I bring it into the dynamic range, cleans up their eyes, kicks in their eye. And then for a man, I'll do a little bit more like sighty, a little heavier shadow. A lot of times I add a 4x floppy over them. I don't use backlight hardly ever. I'm not a big fan of backlight, maybe because, you know, I'm old enough that I was working during the 90s and there was just so much backlight on music videos. I may have been traumatized. I may have late 90s backlight trauma. That's actually pretty funny. I have to think about that and figure out what the PTSD of that is. Late 90s backlight trauma syndrome. So I usually just use a highlight in the background, in a window or something like that, or a lamp, or sometimes I'll throw light on the wall itself. I like to do negative fill. I'll also add a small LED for like a little kick in the jaw, like making sure I don't pick up the hair so much. But I like when they're talking sometimes that this highlight like suddenly appears on their jaw. Looks very natural. For a woman, you know, instead of having a 4x floppy over them creating negative, I'll bring in a fill instead, and I'll make sure that she has a very steep and high, like George Harrell butterfly lighting on them, and then bring in a pizza box or a fill underneath. And for anybody listening that wants to continue the work, when you bring in the fill as like the very last thing you do, and make sure that you're also like part of your job as a DP and a cinematographer is to make the talent, either professional actors or just regular people, make them feel like you're doing something special for them. So bringing in the white card kind of at the last minute, and you're really looking at them and you're moving the card, and then you're like, yes, beautiful, right there. That looks amazing. They hear that. And basically what you're doing to them right there is you're giving them confidence, because humans aren't the most confident people in the world. They're on my hair, I got this, I got that, this side, that side. Everybody has something about their face, their weight, something that they're not happy. So bringing that card in at the last minute and make sure that you are looking to make them beautiful, but really kind of playing that up right there, you're giving them the confidence that they look good. And they do look good. And you want to say that out loud also. Oh, that looks beautiful. You look great there. This looks great. I'm ready to go. You know, that's like the last thing. It's the finishing touch right there. And for a woman over 30, you want a finishing touch. If you want to keep working, you got to make the woman look good. Men, they can take a side light. They're rugged, you know, they're Clint Eastwood. Women, they don't like that so much. You got to make sure they're clean. Just put stuff around them, even if it just bounces. Just fill it all in. And I always carry some kind of soft filter with me, an 8th Black Pro Mist, soft effects filter, classic soft. I don't really care what it is. It's just an 8th, and all that's doing is taking the edge off of them.
What cameras did you use on this project?
For the Heel project, the main camera was the C300. It was a Mark I. We actually shot the job in 1080.
No kidding.
Yeah, that's a 1080 job. It was a C300, a C100, and I think we used the 5D for like the wide. C300 as the main tight, a 5D stacked mother-daughter next to it for like the medium, and then the C100 off on a slider on the side angle that in the end didn't really get used, very rarely. I think it's just a couple of times they used it. They ended up not using it. And when the film premiered at the Sedona International Film Festival, I walked into that room and I was like, wow, that is a big throw. It was a huge screen, a very big theater. You know, we were opening the festival, and the distance from the projection booth to the screen was large. And I was like, okay, let's see how this thing holds up. And the first couple of images came up, and I was like, good lighting, good lenses. I've always said that it's not the camera so much. I always just thought that a camera was a machine that captured light. It was the lenses that was the most important, and the cameramen to know how to manipulate their tools. Now, I like the Canon C300. It's small, it's powerful, it looks good, the color science is good. I am a fan of Canon, especially for doc work. And for the lenses on that job, I used my original Nikon primes from when I was a teenager. That's how I started in the business, is with a Nikon FM2 still body, and my 28mm, my 50mm, my 105, and then I mostly use the 80-200 zoom we bought a second one, and we were using two long zooms. So it's actually Nikon glass with a Canon adapter going to the C300 Mark I body. Now, the impressive thing is, if I told you that I shot that film on an Alexa with an Optimo, you would also believe it. People say all the time, did you shoot that on the Red? And if I know they have a Red package, like, I'm just like, yes. It's like, can you really tell? If I tell you I shot that on the Red, you're going to be like, mm-hmm. If I tell you I shot it on Alexa, you'd be like, yes. I tell you I shot it on the C300, you're going to assume it's in 4K Mark, you know, the Mark II. But really, it's an important thing for people that are coming up into the industry to understand that it's not the camera. It's the cameraman, first of all. And then afterwards, it's the lenses and the lighting. When you're making it happen on set, in camera, not trying to fix anything later in post, if you do your job properly, you know you're doing your job properly. You shouldn't be able to tell.
It's impressive because I know, having worked a lot with the C300 Mark I, depending on who gets their hands on the footage to do your grading, it can often has a certain kind of color tone to the image. And I didn't feel that at all in your grades on this. Watching it projected back at my place, I felt like the skin tones were very similar to the stuff that I've seen coming off of Alexa footage, where it just lands in the right spot. And I don't know who your colorist was on top of it all. You know, the combination of your lighting, the choices you made on that, which I'm going to ask you about, and the lenses that you chose combined with that camera, which seemed like a great pairing.
Yeah, it worked out well. The C100, that camera is okay. It's only at 24 megabits a second, not 50. But we are shooting the cameras in log. And basically, you know, I came up in film. So my background came up in 16, Super 16, and 35. And learning from people and learning myself, you had to do it on set. There wasn't that much fix it in post. It was, you know, you're working with a color timer, adding a couple of points here or there. Like, one of my techniques for saving time in post is just making sure that nobody rolls until the slate is clearly red in the camera, so that the editor just has all of his clips are the slate. Just that little thing right there, producers appreciate, because every little bit that you can save in post-production, then if you do have an issue, you have a little bit more time for color correction. Usually I have one or two issues that I just knew on set I was going to have to, like, this one I'm going to need a little bit of help in post. But I would say 90% of the stuff I'm doing right there on set. So that when I get to post, I just tell them to add a little bit of saturation and a little bit of contrast. In general, it comes right out the way it looked on set with the, like, a Rec 709, you know, LUT on the monitor.
Is that typically your workflow then too, is always to use a 709, or do you use a LUT that you've built with other cameras when you're working?
When I shoot features, I'll create a LUT on the first day or beforehand in prep. But usually I have something that I go into the job with. And then after we have first team in the sets with, like, the real hair and makeup, the real wardrobe, the whole real production design, then I tweak the LUT right then. I give it to my DIT, and I make sure that look, because I'll have different looks for the interior, the exterior, night interior, night exterior, for the different moods that I'm creating in the film, the different ideas that we came up with, basically the different metaphors. And I make sure that that LUT gets applied to the dailies that are going to the director and producer. That, to me, is a really important tip. Figure out what your LUT is, figure out what your looks are, and make sure that whoever's doing the dailies, that pipeline from day one has your looks on it. Because if not, what happens is they get used to something else, or the editor, you know, takes creative control. And then suddenly, at the end of the film, when you go to do the color correction, they've seen it so often in this one way, you know, the human mind doesn't like to make change like that. Suddenly you do a color correction is different, and they're like, hey, what's going on? And so that's why it's important to have it from day one.
Let me switch gears, go back to the lenses that you use, the Nikons. And I've been a big fan of the old Nikon glass. A friend of mine, he was adapting his Nikon lenses onto whatever 16 body he had. And now we've got a set of these Nikon lenses that we use on stuff just because they have a different look. Do you still use these on a lot of projects, or is it very specific to that job?
I use the Nikons with the Canon adapters for, you know, many projects, because I love the look of those lenses. And, you know, they were fast. They're all 2.8s, and the 50 was a 1.4. It was kind of like poor man's Vintage a little bit, you know, poor man's Zeiss or something like that. I mean, they have great glass. They have a great look to them. And like the issue I have with them is the mount. So when you put the Canon adapter on, a lot of times it rocks in the port a little bit. You can get these hard mounts from this guy in Spain, but it's never like flush. What I've done now is I have the C200 so I can shoot in 4K because 4K is in demand. I have a 1080 project. I just hook it up to the monitor through the SDI and I can get a ProRes 422 1080, which is what we're doing right now. Hay House has hired us, the same crew from Heal, to do what they call the Hay House Heal Summit. So we're at it again, interviewing 16 experts. And so this time I have the C200 and the C300, still in 1080 because it's going online. But Mark this time one? I have the my C300 Mark One.
Wow. Great.
From the Heal project, and now I have my C200 that I'm shooting in 1080 out to a Shogun monitor that the ASC Roberto Schaefer has loaned me. And I've gone with the Canon L series lenses because it's pretty undeniable the autofocus on the C200 is the first time in my 20 some odd year career where I'm like, that thing's working. If somebody's leaning forward or backwards in an interview, it's got them like no other camera I've ever seen. And once I saw that happen once, it's what made me kind of lean towards that instead of getting the C300 Mark II, because it works better than the Mark II, but it only works with the Canon lenses. So I switched over, and it is a little bit heartbreaking because, you know, it's like the Nikon Vintage lenses, they don't come out so much anymore. Now I have the Canon lenses. And I only use the autofocus for the interviews, but it makes a huge difference. Before, you were kind of like having to monitor the entire time. You never felt 100% sure, because I'm usually shooting at 2.8, 2.84, 4 to try to make sure and hold it. So now with the autofocus on the C200, I'm feeling very confident. I use that for the tight.
I was definitely impressed with the color match on your tights and your wides. That was the two cameras that were both from the front. One was you said it was a 5D even sometimes?
I think so. I mean, it's been a while since we did that job, man. But I know the third camera was the 5D, and I don't think we would shoot it off axis like that because it's way too hard to operate. As I remember it, and when I went back and looked at some of the stills, it was the C100 off axis, which ended up barely getting used. And it was the 5D, you know, stacked up mother-daughter next to the C300 Mark I. And I think I used my 105 on that for the medium. So 105-1.8. I mean, you cannot miss with that piece of glass. I think that was one of the first lenses I ever had that when I took a photograph and when it came back, I was shooting a Tri-X, black and white Tri-X 400 with my Nikon FM2 still camera, which I gave to my son when he turned 13. My original body thing is just a horse. It just keeps working, you know. Now he's taking Tri-X stills with it. And I remember when I put that 105 on, the pictures that came back from that, I remember having the feeling like that they looked professional. It was one of the first times I saw some of my own imagery and I was like, it looked like a professional had taken it. I was like, oh, it was kind of like my first eye-opening moment that like, hey, you can put a good piece of lens on this and this looks like a photograph somebody else took. I distinctly remember that feeling because it has the soft background, it's very sharp and semi-telephoto. It's such a beautiful, at 1.8, it's just such an incredible piece of glass. It's really, when you hold it in your hand, it's like, yes, mama, you know, the weight of it. It just fits in your hand and it has a lens hood that pulls out the design of it. It's set inside and you pull it out to cover the, I mean, you can just tell when you hold a good lens, you know, especially a vintage one. Yeah. You can feel the weight and the girth to it, and you look inside and you open and close the blades and you're like, yes, not going to make a bad image with this one. You put a good piece of glass on an okay camera with good lighting and the right manipulation of your tools, and nobody knows what you're doing. You could tell them whatever it is. Yes, it wasn't Alexa with Optimo or Ingenue or Panavision Prime, and they're like, yeah, I thought so.
Yeah.
Or you say, yes, it was the red with whatever you want, and they're like, yeah, I knew it.
Yeah. But I've done some work where we were doing some doc stuff with the, I don't know if you remember the SI2K, the silicon imaging camera.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only got like a super 16 size sensor, but we got our hands on these Linos prime lenses, and they're 1.4s, 1.6s, but man, are they sharp. And the image you can get in that combination with that camera, being a smaller sensor using a Cineform codec, was a little bit grainier, a little bit grittier, but the sharpness and the quality you get from the lenses that we were using, it just gave it a quality that wasn't like any other camera. To this day, I look back at the work that I did on that, and then the following job that I shot, the next part of it was shot on the Epic, the Red, and I'm just like, there's just something, like when I look back and forth, it just feels different. I don't know. It speaks to me so much more when I see the images that were on the other camera.
I think that for me, what defines a look of a camera is that for whatever reason, inside you feel it. One looks organic and one looks digital, or one looks electronic. And can I put my exact finger on the technical? No, I can't. I just know that it doesn't have the softness or the organic quality that I like or I recognize or that I go with. And Canon has that. I feel like Canon is like the poor man's Alexa. It's like Alexa and Canon, those two price points, they kind of have this organic feel. They got their color science really dialed in well with the bit rates. And for me, more like Sony and Panasonic, it takes in Red, it has a bit more of an electronic image to me. And that's maybe just coming out of the box. Can you understand those cameras? Can you manipulate those cameras? Can you make the workflow work for you through lensing and lighting and whatnot to soften it up? Yeah, you can. But I think out of the box, Arri and Canon, they got something down that is a bit more organic. Those are basically the two cameras I jump between. The job is bigger, I'm going to take an Alexa. And if it's smaller, then I use the Canon, the C300 Mark II or the C200.
When you shoot C200, if you have to shoot 4K, do you use their higher bitrate codec, the RAW, or do you go to an external recorder?
I've been struggling with that a bit. I wish they would up-res a little bit. The reason I got the C200 was because the screening I went to for the HEAL premiere at the Sedona International Film Festival, the Illuminate Film Festival, the room was so big, I knew it would be the furthest throw that we would probably experience on all the festivals we went to. And it looked great. And that was in 1080. So I figured the C200, it's an 8-bit 420 in 4K. But my rationale was, I made 1080 look that good. I'm sure I could make this poor man's 4K look that good. And at the same time, you can tell your clients, yes, I can give you 4K. Because the majority of stuff is going online. They're ending up crushing it down anyway. But everybody shoots 4K, and you need to shoot 4K. I'm able to offer them 4K, the UHD, which is not even, you know, it's just ultra high def. It's not even real 4K, but they're happy with it. And what I do when I shoot it is, because I use that camera mostly for docs so far. I haven't had it that long, just since November when I started this up film. And what I've been doing with it is I've been shooting the B-roll in 4K RAW at 60. And then I shoot the interviews, I HDMI out into a monitor, because there you get 422. If you just go internal, you get 420. So since it's 8-bit, I'm doing the external monitor, the Shogun, so that I get a little higher resolution and color space. If nothing else, it's mental.
Yeah.
Can I see the difference between 420 and 422? I don't know. Probably not. Will it help me in color correction? Possibly. Will it give me just a little bit more? Yeah, I think so. How much I can notice with my eye? I don't know. Mentally, it makes me feel great. And that's an important part. It gives me confidence. And that's important, that I have confidence in my gear on set.
Especially if you're able to get as much in camera done properly, where you're not relying on fixing it all in post. If you get your look the way you want it in camera, you don't have to do as much futzing around with the color, pushing and pulling. And so you're in a good place.
I'm all about getting it right on set with the colors. I'd rather put gels on the light right there. The less they have to do, the more I get hired. The better it looks when it comes into them, because the producers and the directors are there. They're not inviting you for dailies anymore. It's not like that's happening. They're seeing stuff and they're going there. And when it comes out of the camera looking very close, they're happy. When there's no problems, even syncing, that's why I said earlier, I make sure that nobody rolls their cameras on the multiple camera shoots until the slate is well framed and in focus, so that the editor is only getting clips of information. Because every time he has to go forward or back a little bit to find the slate, that's time. When you add that up in post-production, all the times he has to do those little things, you're wasting time, you're wasting money. You just cut into your color correction time and budget. Or maybe sound. You know what the most important thing a cinematographer should be worried about? Is the music that they're going to be using. Because it will take your regular image and make it cinematic in a second. For me, the soundtrack to a film, the music, I don't know, I'm a weird cameraman like that. I feel like the sound that we capture in the field is more important than the picture. You can cut the B-roll. You can't recover from bad sound. And once you have bad sound, you lose your audience. You lose your audience, nobody's going to see your image. So I always want to make sure my sound man, A, knows what he's doing. Because when you're out in the field, sometimes you're picking sound people up. They get panicked. They don't say things. I always make sure the director listens to what the sound is they're getting. To me, sound is very important. And then afterwards, for the soundtrack, I mean, think about it. You know, when you put music, imagery, it goes from being an okay shot to a cinematic shot, depending on, you know, the music that you're, that they're choosing.
Did you ever work as an editor? Did you ever work on that side of the industry?
I came up in the camera department as a clapper loader, a second, a first, operated for a little bit, and then just jumped to DP.
You weren't out of the can just telling yourself, I'm going to be a DP. You went through the ranks with becoming a DP as a goal.
My initial jump into the industry was I wanted to be a stuntman. And I figured I was doing still photography, and I figured I could get into the industry under the guise of camera, because there was no way my parents wanted me to be a stuntman. So I was using the camera, my still camera, to get into the film industry with my ultimate goal to be a stuntman. And one of the very first jobs I did, this guy climbs a tree and does this high fall out of a tree into a bunch of cardboard boxes. He did it like two or three times. And I was like, there's no way I'm going to be a stuntman. That's the craziest. I was like, that seems so painful. And, you know, I was like, I'll just stay in camera. And I stayed in camera and just kept working. That's the thing is, like, you have to be super enthusiastic. You have to be on point, man. I can tell you two stories about coming up as an AC. One is, I remember being on set and I was super tired. We worked a bunch of days in a row and long hours and this and that. And I was like resting on set. I was on set like the slate. I think I probably was sleeping, had my eyes closed. I wasn't sleeping, but I had my eyes closed there. The first comes over to me and he's like, hey. And I was new in LA and I was like, yeah. And he's like, you see that plane right there? And I was like, yeah. He's like, that has 10 directors, 20 actors, and 15 DPs on it. Every single plane coming to LA, there's a long line of people just waiting to take your job. A long line. Don't sleep on set. And then he just walked away. And I was like, ding! And I was just wide awake. And it gave me a very good perspective of the competition in this town. There is a long line of people waiting to replace you. You really need to be professional. And as a DP, lighting is just not enough. No, you have to be a diplomat. You have to be a psychologist. You have to be fast. You have to have phenomenal people skills, you know, to keep it light and just everybody cool. You know, you're trying to get this vision out of the director's head onto the screen. And some of them don't have to translate it, you know, so you're working with the director, and some do. It's great. But regardless, your job is to get their vision onto the screen. But then you got the first AD and the producer that are just all about the money. When people ask me what I do for a living, I say I make art under phenomenal time pressure. That's what it's like sometimes. It's like, how creative can I be, you know, in this short amount of time? Half the people above the line are worried about the schedule and the budget, and then a few of them are worried about the creative process. And there's the diplomat. You tell the director, I got you, boss. We're going to make it great. And he turned to the AD like, I need 40 minutes. You know, it's like, okay, I'll do it in 20. All right, let's go. And your crew has to be with you.
You said you had two stories.
Mm-hmm. The first one about the plane, you know, and I think he said also about the plane. I remember he was like, they come on the plane, but they leave in a U-Haul. And I was like, dang. And that's true. It is true. They come on the plane, they leave in the U-Haul. It's a tough town. It's competitive here to get a parking spot. in the apartment? Which line should I be in the bank or in the grocery store? It's a very competitive city. You feel it. And you know, because when you leave, it's super relaxing. But when the plane is coming back to LA, you start thinking, I need to do this. I got to call that person. You know, you have to be hustling all the time. I've been freelancing for 25 years. Every month something happens. How is that possible? If I thought about that 25 years ago, I would have never done it. That seems like an impossible algorithm. I enjoy my time off as well. And I really like to work on projects that, you know, motivate me. There's a lot of work that has to do with murder and homicide. I am not down for spending 12 or 15 hours of my day around that.
I look at some of the body of your work, and that's a good point about being able to make work that makes a bit of a difference. Because I know I've been learning a lot about this myself, where you can work on a lot of entertaining pieces, you can work on a lot of commercials, you know, anybody can sell a car or sell products of food, whatever it might be. You kind of start to realize the more you're in an industry that the work that you do, the impact that you can have on people, the things that you can make change around by telling a story. We as cinematographers have a lot of power with the stories that we tell. I mean, for me, and I look at kind of what you do as well, being able to work on projects that make a difference in the world, knowing the amount of power that we have with the visual images we make and the stories that we can tell and we can choose to tell, it's really changed the type of projects that I choose to work on. I mean, it might not always be the best choice because some of these projects don't have the funding that commercials have. And knowing that kind of work, if you can tell those kind of stories and that's what you want to be telling, if you keep telling those stories, the jobs will come. People will recognize the stuff that you're doing, and maybe the funding will come for those bigger projects that are still telling the same kind of stories that you're wanting to be telling, and you're not getting pigeonholed into just shooting commercials all the time because you're making money and people see you as the commercial guy. Maybe you can become the social change guy, and then, you know, the jobs that come through at some point are the projects that eventually will have some money behind them, and, you know, working for nothing on some of these things.
That's right. I 100% agree. But like, who you spend your days with and the work that you choose to do and accept is very important, you know, to me. And I like to work in conscious media. I like to work on projects that are going to make a difference in somebody's life, like way more than I could possibly imagine. You know, we're impacting people beyond what we could even imagine. The first job I think I worked on that I realized was a very powerful film, because when it alters my life, I know it's altered other people's life. It was called Finding Joe. Great film. Pat Solomon, director. Very interesting project about the teachings of Joseph Campbell, and just had a profound effect on, you know, my life. I really recommend that. That documentary reminds me of Heal a little bit in the respect that both of them are kind of workbooks. You can go back and watch them every 3 to 6 months or a year, and you'll think, did they re-edit this? How did I not hear that last time? You know, we're different every time we watch it, and you hear different things. There's very many aha moments in both of those films. That is my goal, where my life path and my work path, they blend together in a way where the lines are blurred and I can't tell. They become one and the same. I was now just recently hired with the Shift Network, and they're starting a series of teachings and interviews with all these different spiritual teachers. Now, I'm currently on the Hay House Heal Summit. You spend hours listening to these people, these great thinkers, these great philosophers, great healers, and just these beautiful concepts of a way of life. You can't help but be affected.
Have you adapted a lot of these things?
Absolutely. I was already on the path, and it just accelerated it beyond my own comprehension. Because you start meeting people and other things happen, and it's just 1, 2, 3, and you're like, wow, this is amazing. I'm so grateful to Kelly Noonan, the director, and Adam Schomer, the producer. Kelly is just phenomenal. Her energy is great. She puts everybody at ease. She takes care of her crew really well. She's passionate about what she does. Adam, same thing. It just flows from the food that we eat to the energy that's created to the pacing of the time and the diversity of our experts. And, you know, when we're on the Hill Project, before we started every interview, we would hold hands, we'd be in the circle, and we would set our intentions that the words spoken here helped humanity, something bigger than ourselves. It moved the world forward. It helped to heal somebody in some way, you know, and then we would ohm right there. We did that before every interview, setting the intention for healing and for the betterment of humanity. How many jobs does that happen on?
Wow. No kidding.
Has that ever happened on any of your jobs?
Nothing like that.
Exactly. We do that on the House Heal Summit also, because we live that life already. And that is what we're going for. What's happening with the Heal documentary is exactly the intentions that we set before each interview. Bigger than us, helping beyond our own scope. I mean, the feedback that Kelly's getting from all these different angles and the coincidences and stuff that's beyond what you could possibly even conceive when you're starting. And those are the projects to be involved in. One of the key elements for lighting on the Heal Doc and almost all the docs I do is to just accentuate what's happening naturally. Walk in, assess the room. A lot of times I'll fly a small LED with a soft box, just arm it out to clean them up in the face. And the other thing that I find that I consistently do is I use this Diva lamp that travels well, just full blast through this custom-made half soft frost flex fill I have that I hang from a C-stand. It's basically equivalent to a 4x frame. And I try to get that as far away from the lamp as possible so that when it hits them, it's a very big source. It's like the bigger, softer source you have, the better they're going to look. So, and basically that's the philosophy from like a commercial job. You throw a 12 by up, you'll double break it with a 4x frame in between there. You take a 12K and 18K and punch that through and have it double or triple diffused. And by the time it gets to them, it's just this big, soft 12 by. Of course, it looks great. Documentary, you're not going to do that. But what you can do is you can take your small unit, your Diva or your Kino or your whatever. The light isn't that important. It's what you're doing with it. A lot of people have lights, but if you don't have the proper accessories for it, like diffusion and black wrap to control it, and then it's just spilling everywhere. So to have a lamp, with a 4x frame of something very soft, like half soft frost, and then you get that as close to the talent as you can, you back the light off as much as you can to fill the whole thing. It's the same concept of having a giant 12 by. So you take these concepts from the feature world and the commercial world, and then you bring them to the doc world, but in a small, it's like the travel size because we travel a lot.
I do something very similar. I've got a 4x3 flex fill, 5-in-1. So I usually carry three of those to every shoot that I go on. So it can be a black or a bounce, or it's a silk that's a similar quality to Chimera fabric. Basically, it's a thicker silk. And then I have a grid that I bought that was bigger than it, like a soft honeycomb grid. And I had that stitched into the flex fill permanently. So whenever I use that flex fill as a key, and it saves me having to flag that soft light bouncing everywhere by having a grid permanently on my flex fill diffusion that pops up.
Nice. That's a really good design. I like that idea.
And I can't believe no one has made these things yet.
For me, I don't like, I mean, I like light grid, but all those like silks and the grids, it's too thick for me. Pat at the Rag Place, which is they make everything here, Super Guy, the Rag Place, very well known in LA for Blue Screen, Green Screen, this and that. I think he invented it, and it's called Half Soft Frost. And it's very thin, but it really creates this creamy quality, and you don't lose the punch of the light. It doesn't kill the power of the light, but it takes away the shadow, and it's very soft. So
That's
I find this a
interesting.
very, it's a very 500, 5,000 kind of scenario. Day exterior, somebody's just getting crushed by the sun, and all of a sudden you just flip this thing open, and all of a sudden they're so creamy. The closer you move it to them, the creamier they get. And you're like, okay, I'm ready to go. Throw a black up on one side. I have another one that has Ultra Bounce, also invented by Pat at the Rag Place. It's, Ultra Bounce on one side and black on the other. So very quickly, I can soften the lamp and add contrast, and I'm ready to go.
That's always been a challenge that I've had, is trying to find the right type of diffusion that gives you that creaminess, but also takes the edge off of the no shadows and the shadows you get. It's just a tough thing. That's the one thing I always watch for. You can tell where the light source is coming from when you see that shadow, and I'm like, I don't want to see that shadow. I don't want to see it unless it totally buries itself with contrast. It's black on one side of the face and lit on the other side of the face. Unless I really want that Rembrandt or whatever you want to go for, where you know where the source is coming from and you feel that nose shadow, I usually try to just blend it as smoothly into the face as I can.
It's really about understanding your craft. For people starting out, yeah, I mentor a lot of people. And there's this concept in the entrepreneurial world is called fail forward. And I always try to encourage people to go out and just just fail, just horribly fail as much as you can. Just get your footage back and be like, that looks terrible. When you spend a lot of energy, and you should really be editing your own footage, or if you're not, make sure you watch your footage when you get back home. Because when it doesn't look good, there's a feeling, I don't know, for me, there's a feeling that comes over me like, just never do that again. How yeah. can I fix this? This is unacceptable. You really need to get out there and just make some mistakes and learn from it. And a lot of it is also shooting in what you think are not optimal conditions. And then you get home and you realize, hey, that looks actually great. How can I recreate that mistake? That mistake is awesome. I mean, mistakes have made people's careers. Absolutely. All of a sudden, it's your look. Meanwhile, you were pinned into a corner so far that you were just trying to paint your way out of it. Turned out it was amazing.
Yeah.
It's what happens, you know. You get put into these corners of time and creativity and location and the schedules and things like that. What I often tell people is when you get crushed into a corner and you don't know what to do, put up two lights diagonally pointing at each other. This is a great place to start. If they say we need to be shooting in 7 minutes, just put one lamp up to your right three quarter and then put one in the back to your left looking back. Basically, these two lights kind of shining at each other. At least it creates some contrast. It creates some backlight. It's like a worst case scenario. And then if you have time, you can tweak it. When all else fails, that is kind of a good saving place to start. You know, the ASC clubhouse is here. And so I try to go to as many, I'm like what they call a friend of the ASC. And they have just amazing guys up there giving talks. And then afterwards, they'll do a Q&A. They have this thing called Coffee and Conversation at the ASC clubhouse. And it's just amazing. You have access to these guys. You become friends with them. And they just tell you these little tips here and there. I remember one time I was getting ready to scout. So I called one of my mentors there, Chris Coleman. And I was like, I got to scout this feature. Do you have any suggestions out of sight? I like to ask for things that I already know a lot, but there's always more to know. And he says to me, I found that the director usually stands where he wants the camera unknowingly. And I was like, that is like, that's the best inside tip right there. Just after years of scouting that you slowly discover that the director naturally ends up standing where he wants the camera. Of course, it makes total sense. They just gravitate to that spot. And to use the time in the van to have all of the creative conversations, because it's going to be the most time that you have with them. I would say just like for people coming up, you know, in the industry that are looking to get in and whatnot, I would say get mentors. Flat out ask people, can you mentor me? That's what I did. I was like, I mentor a lot of people. Can you mentor me? They're like, sure. Here's my email and phone number. Cameramen, they share information like that just very quickly and easily. And then don't worry about the camera. People get obsessed about what camera to use. It's not about the camera. It's about the cameraman. It's about the lenses. It's about the lighting. It's about the reason that you're doing it also. There should be a reason that you're using that lens, that you put the camera there, that you're doing that lighting like that. Shouldn't be for no reason. Shouldn't be because you did it like that before and it looks good. Should be because the sky is rugged and you want to show the contrast, there's a darkness to him, or there's brightness, there's the story he's telling, or his character is uplifting, the colors he's wearing, the color palettes. There should be reasons for the decisions you're making. Even if they're just metaphorical or philosophical, when you're conveying the reasons to the director, to the producer, to the actor, you're getting the message going.
I'm sure all this information is going to be helping somebody else when they hear all of this. You've been giving me some really great insight.
That's the idea. How to help beyond yourself.
Yeah, well, that's the idea of creating these podcast things. There's so much knowledge from people that just don't get a chance to get it out in the world.
If somebody wants to reach out, they can go to my website at gallodp.com. My contact information is on there.
Cool. And that's how I found you. I watched the film, saw your name in the credits. Actually, before I even saw your name in the credits, I was watching the film with my partner, and she's like, get off your phone. I'm like, give me a minute. She's like, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm looking up the name of this DP because I got to get in touch with them because I got to talk to him about this film. She's like, just watch the movie. I'm like, ah, just give me a minute. And then I found you on the IMDb, then found your website and went from there. So yeah, I'm glad it's all worked out.
Be accessible. That's the other thing is like, don't make them fill out a form to contact you.
Yeah.
Everything happens within 2 seconds here in one click. On your website, some imagery should show up within one click. My website is built for my mother, you know, or my grandmother. They should be, if your mom or grandma can't navigate your website, it's too difficult, because all the person's going to do is click through it as fast as they can and then click on something else, click through that as fast as they can.
Well, listen, I don't want to, there's so much more that I'd love to ask you about, and I think we'll save it for another day. There is one thing that I would like to close with, because I run a film transfer company, and I've came up shooting film as well, and I know looking through your gear lists, you have a number of film cameras in your possession, the Bolexes and Super 8 Nitso and that stuff. I just wanted to ask you what your thoughts are about what you learned from working in film rather than working straight with digital, or thoughts around actually using organic motion picture film.
Yep, I definitely grew up in film as a loader, and then a second and a first. They were all film jobs. My first digital job didn't happen until I was a DP, and I think we used the Sony PD150 was the first camera, and then the DVX100A. That was a great little 24p camera. We made some amazing images with that. But coming up in the film world, I still have them, and when I was doing documentary before, they used to call me the triple threat, because I would take still photographs with my Nikon black and white Tri-X, and then I would shoot B-roll either on the Nitso, which is just a phenomenal Super 8 camera. It's ridiculous. It shoots 54 frames per sec and has a reversing motor. You know, has a macro. It has a phenomenal Schneider glass on it. A variable shutter. The camera is insane, like how many things it could do. It's just, it's such a high-end workhorse, that thing. And you pull that trigger and it goes. And it looks like a ray gun also. It's a beautiful looking. And it made great images. And also my Bolex, the 16, I had the adapter that fit my Nikon glass on there, as well as an Ingenue 10-1. And the right glass, the right lighting, the right cameraman, it just looks amazing. You could shoot commercials with those things. And I loved coming up in film. It was terrifying. I remember my agent, Patty Mack, at the time telling me that if you're not doing something every day that makes you nervous, you're not doing your job right. You should be pushing that far. Now, in film, it was possible. You could be messing with the stop. You could be messing with the shutter. You could be messing with the speed. You could be pulling the chemical process, pulling a stop or pushing a stop or pushing two stops, re-rating the ISOs. Before, when people asked me what I was doing, I would say I am a scientist, mathematician, artist, because that's what it was like working in film.
Yeah.
You really had to know the science of it. There was a lot of science going on. And there was a lot more math. You were making compensations like crazy. You were constantly making compensations, and you were filtering in the matte box and filtering on the lights way more. The DP's filter box, I mean, that was top secret. That's how you made your living. Mixing, you know, the minus magenta green with like the tobacco aether. We'd come up with these crazy things that it looked great. And we did everything in camera. So that's where even my still photographs, I adjust a lot of my cameras. I have settings for day interior, cool, warm, this and that. Because a lot of people, I don't trust that they're going to do post, or they don't have the budget for post. So I just bake it in. So when it comes out, like, people are terrified of baking it in now. They would never do that. But some jobs, I know that they're just going to, if I don't bake it in, that they would release it in log. Because they don't know any better. You know, some jobs are small. They don't have that mentality even. So I keep all my cameras with custom settings as well. I'm comfortable with that. I know it's going to look good. The biggest difference for me between film and video is that in video, you're not guessing anymore. I'm not nervous when I go to sleep. I know exactly what happened. I could see it right there. In film, you were waiting for the neg report the next day. You wanted the lab to come and say, good neg. Was there hair in the gate? Did we miss something? Was something soft? There was this really beautiful thing called dailies, right? And you'd be on a feature, and everybody would go at lunch or after we wrapped and watch dailies, your focus puller, your gaffer, your key grip, the director, costume, makeup, and you would watch the work that you did, and it created this real bond between the crew. It became very family-like. The thing I missed the most is the crew bonding and family connection of watching dailies. You could still do that in digital, but why? You're seeing it on set right there. Film has a great look. And now the cost of Super 16 at the lab is pretty close to, you know, some of the digital jobs, because the cameras are so affordable. You can shoot Super 16 on commercials, and it looks great. Everybody should know how to shoot film. It's terrifying. You are really paying attention. You got your light meter out. You're really becoming a cameraman there. You're really learning about contrast and ratios. I don't know. I can't tell the difference now. People get crazy with cameras. I'm not like that at all. If I'm going to be crazy about something, I'm going to be crazy about lenses. And I think the lens is way more important than the camera. People get crazy with the dynamic range and this and that in the film, and you can tell it's film. I can't tell anymore. Can you?
It's hard. I'm hard pressed. Even when we're scanning stuff at the studio, I find that the things that you used to just be like, oh, there's so much fleck in it. There's a light leak here. There's dust on the nag. Those are the things now that people are embracing because they're like, oh, it doesn't look like digital. I don't have to add that in post. Right. It's all baked in. This is great. This is organic. It's like now mm-hmm. for me, whenever I pitch a project, I rarely pitch to shoot something on film unless the project has already had the suggestion to shoot on film. Because for me to say, you know, I think this should be shot on film, it's got to be, and then I have to make up a battle and an argument or some kind of reason to make them believe that this has to be on film. Then if anything goes wrong and they see little of those things, it's all back on you, and you're the one who pushed film. So for me, that battle is a hard one to fight, especially, you know, it's all going to come back on your head. If production comes to me and they say, you know, maybe we could try film, I say, here's some examples. This is why it might work great. Or I might just tell them, you know what, this I'd love to do it on film, but for what you want to achieve, film is not the right medium for this project. Vice versa. Mm-hmm. It can go either way. You know, you gotta pick the right, as you were saying earlier, the right camera, the right tool for each project that you're on.
Yeah. I got a job last year. It was a low budget job, and the reason I got it, because I knew how to shoot film. The job was Super 16, 35 millimeter and Alexa. And I was like, that's basically my whole career. that's the chronological version of my career. I was like, yeah, of course I could do that. It was for a feature film with this director, Roey. And the first day was on 35. It was an Aeroflex BL, right? The old BL. And we start to roll. And I was like, hold on. And I was like, cut immediately. Like, I was like, hold on. First of all, I put my eye on the eyepiece and the camera started to roll. And I thought, what is that flickering? What is a flickering thing there? And I instantly was just like, oh my God, it's the shutter. I almost forgot about it for a second. I was like, and then there was that sound, that glorious, beautiful sound of the film running through the gate right by your ear. And as soon as I heard that, I realized we were shooting film. I came off the eyepiece and I yelled, cut, 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 cut. And the director looked at me like, what? Why are you yelling cut? And I was like, we're shooting film here. I was like, where's my meter? Hold on for a second. I need to actually like really pay attention. I was like, what filter do I have in the box? What's the stop? What's the ISO? I had to like go through it. It had been so long since shooting it. When I heard the film going through the gate and it just washed over me. You can very easily miss the exposure here. And I just had to double check everything real quick. And then like I took my meter out. I thought about all the calculations again. I was like, okay, I feel confident. All right, let's go. I was right. But the sound of film going through the gate is money. That purr is like money, and you need to be nailing it because the monitor that's coming off there is for operating only. I mean, it is so bad, the monitor. So I love film. You know, my first job as a DP, I mean, it was kind of amazing. I was hired by Quentin Tarantino for this documentary called Full Tilt Boogie. Him and Robert Rodriguez, because the focus puller I was working with, Ziad Duetti, who's become, you know, a very well-known director now and had the Academy Award nomination for the first film at Lebanon 2 years ago, foreign film. He was working with Andre Sekula. That's who we came up with. And they had just shot Reservoir Dogs when I met them. So we got together, and then we did all these commercials with Andre, and then we did these indie films where Quentin like would do cameos and like Sleep With Me, and it was all the same crew. And then Quentin started Pulp, and so I was working on Pulp as an assistant as well, like day playing there. And the next picture they did was with Robert Rodriguez. They were doing Dust Till Dawn, And LA, it's a very small film crew anyway, so everybody knows each other. And Quentin and Robert were doing a non-union film right in Los Angeles, right? They were going to pay health benefits, this and that. They were like super indie, right? The indie kings, right? And so Quentin's like, there's going to be a huge strike here. Let's hire Gallo as the DP and Sarah Kelly, who was a PA on Pulp Fiction, to direct it, and let's make a documentary. So, we're shooting 16 millimeter on this thing. And we knew all the crew, so, we had crazy access. I think that they show this film, Full Tilt Boogie, in film schools still. Like, it affects people. It's before there was behind the scenes. We're just hanging out, jamming, like George Clooney and like Quentin, and just like Robert. Just a crazy scene going on, shooting out in Barstow during that. And that was like my very first picture. And we went to like the Venice Film Festival with it, and I went to South by Southwest. It got picked up by Miramax. I just thought every job was going to be like this, like my first film ever. And all these things happen. And then you realize it takes a while to get back to the festivals again sometimes. Those were exciting times. When I look back on it now, I say, wow, what a blessing. How do you end up in those circles? Just through sheer effort. You just have to keep going. Just everything happens in groups, and you just have to keep pushing. I didn't have anything to fall back on, so I had the choice. So take every job and always be doing the best possible. That's what happened a lot of times is I was just highly focused at doing, no matter what it was, clapper loader, second, first, op, DP, because somebody is watching you. Somebody is watching you work that you have no idea is watching you. And if you're doing your job right, they're going to single you out and hire you for something else. And that's what happens, and that's how you progress. If you're messing around, if you're doing it half-assed, if you're doing it lazy, there is no time for that. There's no place for that. There's a long line of people ready to go, enthusiastic and hardworking.
Well, that's a good point to leave it at. I mean, I've done a number of these podcast interviews before in the past, and the things that you spoke of from technical side of things, and I appreciate the fact that you've taught a lot of workshops, and I can recognize that you know how to speak about things that are of value for people to hear. I like your what you called your Taoist approach when you go into a room.
Can't fight nature.
It's tough. It's tough, and sometimes you have to, but.
She'll teach you that lesson over and over. Unless you got a big crew in the five ton, don't try fighting her too much. Embrace her.
I guess the trick with the interviews is that you just, depending on how long your interview runs for and where the sun's moving, sometimes you just don't have that ability
That's right.
to not
Yeah.
do a bit more lighting.
That's right.
You walk into a room, you're like, wow, that dusk sunset light coming in here is gorgeous. Let's roll. 15 minutes later, there's no light in this room anymore.
Yeah, dangerous. But you want to get it in that window in between where you don't notice the ambient dropping.
Exactly, yeah. Perfect. Yeah, that's great.
Justin, appreciate your time,
I
and
appreciate your time. This
thanks
is,
for
thanks.
doing it, and cool.
I've no real plans to monetize or do anything off this. This is purely for my own personal interest to talk to people that I can learn from and, share knowledge and share ideas, and from there, if it goes into someone else's mind and ears, then great. It's very easy to become the podcast guy. I'm a cinematographer, and that's what I do. Everything I do in my life revolves around creating images.
Not only do you shoot, but you're also running this other thing. I think that's very
Yeah,
helpful. It's more, it's more.
I'm.
I think it's more beneficial than it's not.
Well, one of the next ones I want to do is with a makeup artist because the last feature I shot, we had a lot of issues with the talent that had, bad skin and shine and all these different things to take care of. And I went through test after test after test, this kind of lighting, this kind of diffusion, this kind of filter. I'm like, how can I fix this? And then the one day, the makeup artist that we had normally had couldn't make it in. A different one came in, and I was like, what just happened? She looks awesome. And then we sat down, I took her up to my grading suite, and I was like, this is what I've been working with, this is what I've done. She's like, oh, well, this is what I would do. What she didn't do is I would have done a T-zone thing here, I would have put a concealer in this area, built a total matte finish on her face first, and then worked on the makeup afterwards, then did this, and that would have helped you out. You wouldn't have had, I'm like, fuck. When you can work with somebody who really knows what you're trying to do and they are trying to do the same thing, like, this is great advice because now at least I've got a language for a different makeup artist. I can say, you can offer some advice and see if they are like, oh yeah, it's right. Of course, I knew that. I just didn't even do it. And it's like, okay, great. Save my ass right now.
That's awesome. That's a good point. All right, sounds
Okay,
great.
I'm gonna
All
let you
right,
go.
Dustin, well, I appreciate you reaching out. Thanks, man. Have a
Thanks
good
so
day.
much. Yeah, you too.
Be in touch.
All right,
All
bye.
right, bye.